Welcome to The Sit Down. I am Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. The Sit Down is the latest addition to our Raging Chicken Radio podcast. On The Sit Down, we talk to activists, public intellectuals, investigative journalists, and rabble-rousers of all sort to deepen our discussions and prepare us for the struggles ahead. Raging Chicken Radio is a project of Raging Chicken Press. Check out all our citizen journalism at ragingchickenpress.org. You can subscribe to Raging Chicken Radio on Podbean, on Stitcher, Google Play Music, and iTunes. Subscribing to Raging Chicken Radio is one of the easiest things that you can do to help support this podcast and all the work that we do with Raging Chicken. Seriously, you click on it, you subscribe to it, and while you're there, leave us a comment. You comment on it, you subscribe, it boosts us up in the ratings, and we get this word out to more people. And if you really want to help build a progressive activist media network for PA and beyond, you can become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $2 a month. $2, folks! That is less than the cost of beer or a cup of coffee. Just go to ragingchickenpress.org and click on Become a Member under the Support and Membership tab. Or if you're listening on Podbean, just click Become a Patron and you'll be on your way. Be sure to check out all the thank you gifts for each membership level while you're there. I mean, come on, because you got to have swag, right? We got pins. We got kind of opportunities to come onto the podcast, t-shirts, books. Come on, become a member. I swear to God, it's real fun. So today on The Sit Down, I'm very, very psyched about today's episode. Today we're talking social movements and public intellectuals with Jason DelGondio. DelGondio is a scholar activist and assistant professor of rhetoric and public advocacy at Temple University. His scholarship focuses on the theory and practice of social justice, especially when it comes to activism and social movements. He approaches these topics through the intersections of rhetoric, philosophy, and performance. His public writing has engaged with issues such as corporate control, the rhetoric of the Obama and Bush administrations, immaterial labor, autonomy, performance art, the Occupy movement, spontaneous uprisings, and the relationship between neoliberalism and the university. So you get it. This guy cuts a wide path, folks. He is involved in these movements. His writings have appeared in Counterpunch, Truth Out, Radical Philosophy Review, and New Political Science, Fanex, Dissident Voice, and the Journal of Aesthetics and Protest. In his book, Rhetoric for Radicals, a handbook for 21st century activists, DelGondio seeks to help activists focus on effective communications that is often lacking in even some more experienced activists. As he argues, radicals have important messages to deliver, but are often so caught up in the passion of their causes that they often suffer from a credibility gap because of their lack of coherent message and delivery. Rhetoric for Radicals is a guide that can help activists develop strategic communication skills to be effectively heard. So psyched to have him on the program. Jason, welcome so much. Huge, big welcome to The Sit Down.
Hi, Kevin. How are you doing today?
Hey, you know, hanging in there. It's, summertime, school's out, and got a lot going on. You know, it could be the summer, but we're in the middle of, kind of towards the end now of the primary season and looking ahead towards presidential elections come fall. All sorts of talk about social movements. Social movements are in the air, so you're the perfect person to have on.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. So listen, I thought, you know, we could start off with some of the conceptual stuff, especially for going back to rhetoric for radicals. I mean, you make this claim, this radical claim to some degree, provocative claim at the very least, that communication kind of helps make our world or makes our world. And that is kind of what is some of the energy behind rhetoric for radicals. So give us a little bit of context about this focus on communication and what you're trying to bring to the table in that book.
Sure. Well, to back up for a moment here, I got involved with social movements, activism, and radical politics while I was in grad school at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. And during this time period, I was studying communication, right? And so anyways, I was a late bloomer in terms of activism. Most people start in their middle late teens. I didn't start until I was about 24, 25. I was a PhD student studying communication. As I got involved with these movements, though, I started to see a gap between what we were trying to achieve and the skill set and strategies in which we were trying to achieve that, right? Mm-hmm. So I was developing a lens to see the world through communication, right? Mm-hmm. And then from that point, the question is, well, how does communication and rhetoric relate to activism, social change, and social justice? Now, in terms of communication creating our shared social world, if you do a thought experiment, and if you were to strip the human being of all communication, what would be left? It's pretty much impossible to imagine, right? So take away all language, all symbol use, all discourse, all storytelling, all nonverbal communication, and all of a sudden, you can't really comprehend what that would look like.
Well, I go back to my Star Trek days, and I just think we've got bags of mostly water, you know?
Right, exactly.
Mostly water.
So I start from a position where communication is ontologically foundational to human experience, right? And if that's true, then how do we incorporate that into a worldview that seeks for political change and social change, right? So, for instance, at a more, let's say, concrete level, the language we use acts like a filtering process, right? I'm not the only person that said this. Obviously, you're familiar with the scholars as well. But language both reflects a worldview and also deflects other worldviews. Language includes certain ideas, but also excludes other ideas. And so as an activist, the question becomes, what language do you use to invite people into your movements? What language do you use to encourage people and inspire people to support your cause, right? And so just looking at language alone, language is a very important tool to use to mobilize people for social good.
Well, you know, I look at this and I thought that with the publications of Rhetoric for Radicals was so timely because, you know, the case that you just laid out right there about the importance of communication to be able to do things, right? Not just to kind of say things or express them, but how that actually helps us do things. This is something it seems like the right has understood for quite some time.
Sure.
We have, you know, I always find this, it's very ironic in some ways because when we're sitting here from the left, we talk about kind of, you know, doing things together, about collectivity, about solidarity and so on. Mm-hmm. But very often our approach to things is very, very individualistic, right? We don't mm-hmm. think about that kind of exchange or, you know, I always think about communication as a way of kind of assembling, right, our, you know, our movements. Whereas on the right, you know, you've got, you know, the word labs, right? I mean, you've got the right wing kind of think tanks that are very cognizant about the effectivity of language. So when your book came out, it was thinking about, you know, here's the kind of thing that we need to be thinking about on the left and think kind of almost grow up as a movement again, right? Sure. Where we're thinking about, yes, we have the passion and all this, but if we want to take that passion and move it towards kind of effective change, right, to actually affect things in the world, then this language stuff, this stuff matters.
Sure. One of the things that I try to argue is that activists and organizers are full-time communicators and full-time rhetoricians, even if they don't realize it yet, right? So that's one of the motivations for my book, right? Mm-hmm. You're already doing this. You're already engaging in communication. You're already crafting messages, but are you doing it consciously, right? When I say consciously, are you sitting down and thinking about how to adapt your messages to different audiences and to what end and to what effect, right? In terms of the potential reluctance on the left to do this kind of work, it might be tied to a certain kind of belief in the truth of the issue, the truth of the situation. So, mm-hmm. For example, a personal example, when I first got involved with activism, I read Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. Everyone reads that, right? And I figured, well, if all my friends just read this book, they'll have the same worldview that I do. And obviously, I learned real quick that's not true. Mm-hmm. So I would have friends who I was very close with that would read that book, but they would put it down and it wouldn't move them in the same way. So the question is, well, why was I moved by this book, right, this truth of this book, and other people weren't? At that point, you start to realize that, well, human beings are very complex creatures, mm-hmm. right? And most people don't want to get out of their comfort zone. Most people tend to navigate towards the status quo. But as an activist, it's our job to break them from the status quo, break them from their identification with and addiction to the social norms that we have right now. And that really is a rhetorical apparatus. That's a rhetorical process.
Well, and I think that, you know, this goes back to one of the things that George Lakoff has talked about kind of sure. extensively, right? When it goes back to the whole idea in cognitive psychology that, you know, people think in frames too. So it's right. not just a matter of, you know, speaking truth to power. Of course, that's important, but truth by itself does not set us free, right? It's kind Correct. Of how that truth then becomes something that we could all mobilize around. And one of the key factors is like, well, what's the way in? Simply speaking facts to someone, or what we see as the facts, the truth of, say, Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, by just saying that to people doesn't change their minds. It requires right. us to do things with language and to actually find a way in. And one of the things that I really liked about your book, Rhetoric for Radicals, was that you seem to understand the complexity, as you just said, of the human being, that there's not one silver bullet, that you right. just say these things and right. people think things. But it means we actually have to engage with other people as complex right. human beings, that it's not just one size fits all, but it really means having to pay attention, and you make this case too as well, and listening to each other and looking for those kind of ways in that we have that conversation and move forward, which also requires us, right, to be open right, to right. the hearing of what other people's perspectives are, not just dismissive of them, but like they're crazy nut jobs, right?
Sure, right. Yeah, on that last point, I guess I want to make room for having our own emotional reactions to, let's say, Donald Trump and thinking that he is crazy, he doesn't belong here, which is all true, right? At the same time, though, we have to also get past our own emotional reaction and then start to think strategically about how do we convince other people that this person should not be the Republican nominee and definitely not the president of the United States, right? And so it really takes listening, right? But then listening almost, for a lack of a better metaphor, listening almost like a therapist, right? And trying to understand what makes his supporters tick in the way that they do. What makes certain people not want to deal with issues of racism or classism or homophobia? What's going on there, right? Mm-hmm. And at certain times, we want to be, we may want to yell, may want to be angry, may want to march in the streets, which is all fine. I've done a million times. I'll do it in the future. In other situations, though, you have to learn how to have a good conversation, right? And get that person, move that person slightly towards your views, whether it's through your examples, your analogies, your metaphors, your personal experience, or what kind of rhetorical tools must you apply in that moment with that audience to make that happen?
No, that's such a great point. And I look at that, you know, Donald Trump is, you know, in some ways he's a, you know, he's a case study right now of what it actually means to respond to somebody. Because I think for a lot of us, you know, you watch what this guy says and it seems objectively true that he's a racist. He's off his rocker, right, that nobody's going to take him seriously.
Right.
Yet we have facts on the ground that suggest otherwise. And then the question is, what are those facts on the ground? It doesn't mean that why are all these people racist? There are some that are just racist, right? You know, and when in labor organizing, right, you have a way when you're organizing a shop, right? You're talking to people. You have your ones and you have your fours, right? Your ones are the people that are going to be, you walk in, you say, we're organizing union. They're there. You don't need to convince them at all. And then you have their fours that no matter what you say to those people, right, there's no way that they're ever going to join. So you don't waste our time with those fours, right? But everyone else is kind of in that middle ground, and that they have some conflicted feelings on it. Because when they hear, so like Donald Trump, for example, talk about the way that, you know, American jobs have been, you know, have been exported and we're not getting our due. I think that resonates with a lot of people, not because they're racist, right? Because that feels true at a lived experience level.
Right. And the question then becomes, how do we interject into that lived reality that they have, right? And then propose an alternative lived reality, the kind of the world the way we see it, right? And that's not easy to do. And I think an important part here is that when people think of rhetoric, they think just of manipulating language to a certain degree, right? But a big part of being a good rhetor is analyzing the social and political landscape, analyzing your audience, analyzing the demographics, and figuring out what's going on in the American psyche right now. What's going on with the psyche of the audience you're talking to? But that involves, though, both the lived experience as well as the larger social structures and how those things come together. So, for instance, with Donald Trump supporters, I agree. Some people just are blatant racist. There's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. Other people, though, identify with his economic message, that he'll restore economic greatness to America again, things like that. And so many of the supporters feel as though they've been displaced economically, right? But they're not seeing that, well, it's the American economic system, not just a few choices here and there. When you ship jobs overseas, when you have a dwindling middle class, when the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, sure. Now the question is, are these people that are his supporters, do they have a proper analysis of the economic situation of American capitalism, right? And so how do we interject that, right? That would be a rhetorical question.
Absolutely. And how do we project that in such a way that is not simply about, here's the analysis,
right.
But which is part of that, again, that give and take in conversation. Like I think, for example, one of the tactics that I find very, very effective, right, especially when you're doing kind of organizing work or so on, is simply to tell my stories, right. Tell particular stories that are meaningful, that capture some of this stuff. Not to, you know, again, I'm just like the next guy. I'll get up on my soapbox once in a while, right, and I got to say what I got to say. But other times it's, you know, going to say, listen, this matters to me because of X, Y, and Z.
Right.
This matters to me because here, now I look at my neighbor, right? I've got four, this is true, right? I've got four people in my neighborhood, friends of my kids, for example, like that, who've been laid off from their jobs, right? People who had fairly decent kinds of jobs. Right. And you watch, again, new trade deals kind of get passed. You watch people lose their jobs. This is something that we can't allow to happen, right? And it's a simple story. I can point to real people that this is happening to. And I've always reminded of one of the tools that Frank Luntz, you know, the kind of right-wing wordsmith guy, what he always uses, you know, he looks for people when they start nodding their heads, right? Sure. That's always a signal to me when you're kind of talking with folks, they say like, yeah, that makes sense to me, right? Sure. And that means it makes sense, and not just an intellectual level, right? But sure. If say this jives with what my experience is.
Right, right. And with that, to follow up on that and extend that, if we look at it through the lens of rhetorical instruction, right, how mm-hmm. to do rhetoric well, I think telling your personal story is an excellent tool, an excellent strategy. At the same time, though, don't be afraid to craft that story, right? I'm sure you do. I'm not talking to you personally.
No, exactly.
But in general, some people might think, oh, well, it's my personal experience. I can't get it wrong. Well, it's not about getting it right or wrong. It's about being most effective with your audience. So sit down and think about the points you want to highlight about your personal experience, right? How your audience might respond to that, and how can you bring about a certain kind of cognitive shift by telling your story? In other words, you have to highlight certain points. It's not just the experience itself, but what the experience means to you and to your audience members.
No, absolutely. And I can't think of a better time for these issues to be front and center. We're coming up on a break right now, but when we come back from the break, one of the things I want to talk with Jason about is that, you know, we've got kind of real case in point going on right now. I mean, we've got the end of an unprecedented Democratic primary in so many ways. For the first time, certainly in my recollection, but since, you know, probably, God, the 1930s, where questions about socialism and economic justice and fairness, about redistribution, about all sharing in the kind of democratic enterprise are front and center thanks to the Bernie Sanders campaign. Sure. Now, Bernie Sanders is, you know, obviously he's, you know, I'll leave that little shred of hope out there for folks who still want to say that he's got a shot at it. Like, from my perspective, look, this is done, right? The primary process is done. I'm not saying the movement is done or anything like that, but you've got people who have been involved in this for real reasons, right? Been involved with the Bernie Sanders campaign, not just because they wanted to elect a president, because they believed in the message and the movement. And we're at this kind of turning point in time, in my view, when the big question is, what's going to happen with the energy of that movement? Where does that movement go from there? So when we come back, I want to kind of pick Jason's brain a little bit about kind of how we might kind of come at this social movement. What are some of the issues that should be front and center for the social movement? And how might we look forward to kind of building this movement through some of that kind of effective communication that he's talking about. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be back right back after this with Jason Del Gagne.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1877. It became known in Pennsylvania labor history as the Day of the Rope. 20 Irish miners were hung for allegedly belonging to a secret group of labor radicals known as the Molly Maguires. The Mollies traced their history back to Ireland in the 1840s. The story goes that an Irish woman by that name stood up to the English landlords. Men fighting for Irish rights would declare themselves sons of Molly Maguire. To what extent this secret organization actually operated in the United States is debatable. Irish workers who came to the United States often faced harsh discrimination. Many job sites would announce, "Irish need not apply." One place they did find work was in the often dangerous Pennsylvania coal mines in Schuylkill County. Franklin Goins, president of the Reading Railroad, controlled the mines in the 1870s. In late 1874, he announced a wage cut of 20%. The miners went out on strike. During the strike, the Mollies were accused of sabotaging the mines and even murdering mine supervisors. The mine operators quickly blamed any act of violence in the region on the Molly Maguires. Determined to infiltrate the Mollies, Goins hired the notorious Pinkerton detectives. The Pinkertons sent in Irish American James McParlin under an alias to attempt to join the group. Based on his testimony, 20 miners were hung for murder. They were found guilty, even though much of the testimony presented in the case was inconclusive and contradictory. In 1979, the governor of Pennsylvania posthumously pardoned John Blackjack Kehoe, one of the alleged leaders of the Mollies. In 1970, Sean Connery starred in a movie based on the story.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Well, Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's The Sit Down. Today we're talking with Jason Del Gondio. Jason Del Gondio is an assistant professor of rhetoric and public advocacy at Temple University, and he's the author of Rhetoric for Radicals, among a bunch of other stuff. One of the things I want to put another plug in for is another great book for Jason is Educating for Action with Anthony Nocella. Is his last name Nocella?
Nocella.
Anthony Nocella. It's a great book. It's kind of a really nice compendium to Rhetoric for Radicals, because you actually get it's a collection with voices of many activists bringing their experience to the pages and talking about some of the same things we're talking about here, and even broaden out the discussion even further. So like I was saying before the break, we've got kind of a real social movement in the making right here. I mean, in some ways we can look at the movement around the Bernie Sanders campaign, the kind of millions of people who've been engaged, as just the opportunity to kind of move progressive, radical values forward. We can also see the intersections between the Bernie Sanders campaign and Black Lives Matter movement. We can see that this is not just a movement that is about electing Bernie Sanders to the presidency, right? But this is a movement of people that are energized moving forward. So Jason, I thought maybe way we could start this off is just a little bit about kind of what's your perspective on what's been happening with the Bernie Sanders campaign? I mean, how would you begin to account for why this movement has really been sparked, and what the issue, you know, the fact that we're talking about kind of income inequality, that we're talking about socialism, that we're talking about things that have been like taboo in American politics for like at least a generation. I mean, how do you begin to kind of talk about why we're seeing this now?
Well, I think there are a lot of different factors involved with this. One is the material conditions of American lives, right? So as the middle class shrinks, as the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, et cetera, there's a certain kind of material reality that people are responding to. And so you have Bernie Sanders that in many ways, and based on my perception, speaks very honestly about these conditions and how can we improve these conditions for the majority of Americans, right? But then if you take a long-term view, though, I don't think Bernie Sanders is doing this simply on his own. I think in some ways it's an outgrowth of the Occupy Wall Street movements. Mm-hmm. Now, when I say that, though, I want to be careful. I don't think there's a one-to-one causal relationship between Occupy and then Bernie Sanders' success and popularity. But I think Occupy Wall Street created a certain kind of context in which we could talk about economic inequality, in which we talk more about social change, social justice, right? There's also the issue with Black Lives Matter, which is a direly important social movement happening right now. And with, if you look at that, so let's say last 5 years or so, right, Occupy, then Black Lives Matter, and then Bernie Sanders comes along, there's a certain kind of push towards the left in the country, not by everyone, unfortunately, but at least by large segments. And I think that kind of social and political context allows Bernie Sanders and his message to resonate with more and more people. Now, the question becomes, though, how do you galvanize that support and sustain that support beyond the DNC and beyond the elections in November? That becomes the real question.
Well, and I think this gets right to the heart of kind of what you're trying to get at with radicals, rhetoric for radicals, and kind of our discussions around communication. Because, you know, very much what I, again, sorry to endlessly plug your book. I'm sure you won't mind, but but really, what I think is really important about it is that it asks us to think about communication not simply in terms of, okay, how do I kind of make this case or make this argument? It also talks about, you know, that communication context, so that when we're talking about sustaining a social movement, right, about moving that forward, we're also thinking about those languages to kind of make sense of who we are and what we're there and what we're going to do. So right now, we're kind of at this turning point where the Democratic nomination is pretty much sewn up. We've, you know, even seen Elizabeth Warren kind of throw in her hat, which has pissed off a whole lot of kind of progressive and leftists. And now they're kind of being anti-Elizabeth Warren on this one, which is really kind of interesting. But that kind of energy and passion that people felt for the Bernie Sanders campaign, like you said, is not going away. And I think it's going to be as interesting what happens outside the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, that is what happens inside. So, you know, if you're sitting there, right, and Raging Chicken Press will be there, so I hope to run into you down there.
I'll definitely be there, yes.
You know, if you're thinking about kind of as part of doing some of that organizing or engaging with activists around there, what are the kinds of things that you think you'd be looking at to try to move that forward, to help that movement thrive?
I think one of the reasons, again, another reason why I think Bernie Sanders has been successful, at least his message has been successful, is that it gives people a sense of hope, right? And I think hope is really important. Social movements need hope. Activists need hope, but also people in general need hope. And so I think if we're looking at this through a rhetorical lens, if the activists and protesters outside of the DNC, if they can tap into people's hope, if they can inspire hope, right, I think that will be more inviting to people. I kind of see the world through kind of two emotional lenses, fear and hope. Mm-hmm. I think lots of people who don't get involved with social movements, they're afraid to do so because they're not sure what the outcome will be, right? In other words, if they're going to break with the status quo, if they're going to break with the social norm, right, that puts a lot of uncertainty into that person, and they're afraid of what's going to happen, right? On the flip side, though, if you can acknowledge that fear, but then also acknowledge, well, in doing so, we're creating more hope for the future, I think that's the balance we need. And so in terms of the rhetoric of the movement surrounding the DNC and outside the DNC, I would really look for what kind of messages are being deployed that operate upon this notion of hope, right? Mm-hmm. You have critique of the Democratic Party. You have critique of the Republicans, critique of the two-party system, critique of the American economic system. At the same time, though, if you don't give people hope, they're not going to fight for you or fight with you.
This is a great point, and I think that I get into this discussion very often, right? I mean, right now, my union, ABSCUF, we're in our basically working a year without a contract now. It looks like we're headed towards, unless things dramatically change, we're headed towards our first ever strike. Wow. And one of the questions that always comes up in kind of organizing around that context is about people's comfort level. Right. Which I think is exactly what you said. I mean, you've got this hope and you've got this fear. And one way of resolving that issue about comfort level, say, well, listen, everybody can do what they feel comfortable with, right? Mm-hmm. Then I have the echoes of, say, Naomi Klein in my head, right? Mm-hmm. When she's talking about what's required right now for climate action, where she's basically saying, look, it's not okay, right? It's not okay to just everyone just keep on doing what they feel comfortable doing. We actually have to make that push, right? And to do something radically different. And what I always think about when we're talking about that hope, right? We're saying that, look, we're not promising you that everything's just going to be, you're going to feel nice and safe all the time. But it means that, you know, you're going to have to move forward, right? Sure. And that we're all going to have to move forward. And there's risk that's involved that you're going to be safe about it. But the question is that hope that is not just about that hope in the future, but that if I step forward, that there's people beside me that have got my right? It's that kind of being together, which actually answers the safety question, answers that comfort level thing. Right. And we hear this from stories from activists all the time.
Sure.
They say that, man, I found a family when I got organized. You know, we hear that kind of language describing what it means to be part of a movement. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
No, I agree 100%. I think one of the important aspects of activist work and one of the most meaningful aspects of activist work is actually working with other people and realizing you're not alone. So it's easy within our kind of society to sit home by yourself, watch TV, watch the news, read your stories online, and you'll have your own analysis, your own critique, and your own hopes, but not being connected to anyone or anything, right? And it's easy to think, well, I'm all by myself, only I think these things. But once you're in the streets, marching with thousands of people, having makeshift conversations on the side during these activities, all of a sudden you realize you're part of a larger collective. And obviously, being part of a larger collective, I think, is built into the human species, right? I mean, we are a collective phenomenon, right? Mm-hmm. The way we walk, the way we talk, if it wasn't for our caregivers growing up, we wouldn't have language, we wouldn't know how to move through the world, etc. And so recognizing and actually experiencing being part of that larger collective definitely sustains one moving into the future and gives you more motivation for doing so. And that's kind of what you're talking about, right?
Absolutely.
Going through that experience of knowing that I'm not by myself, that other people have my back as we move forward trying to create a better world. So yes, 100%, I agree.
Yeah, and I think also the importance of, you know, when you think about that hope, kind of what are those very simple messages, as you're kind of saying, is the simple message that kind of help us see that. And, you know, one of the things that I'm still waiting for this to really catch off, we had a little uptick, but then seems to kind of move up. But I in my head, if I had my wish for how to provide that kind of like message or image of hope moving forward, I think about, you know, the House Finch. Right. Mm-hmm. I think about the House Finch that landed on Bernie's podium. Right. I mean, there were amazing, you know, logos that came out after that to say that, you know, Progressive Party and so on, that basically mirrored the way that they do the red, white and blue for the elephant and the donkey. Right. But then had that rant. I mean, in my mind, it's like, what an amazing image. The idea that something so simple can remind us that we're kind of like all in this together. And, you know, whatever we want to talk about, the, you know, the way that you know, it seems like this little bird gets sent, right? I mean, that's the way that it appears, right?
Sure.
The little bird gets sent from a power greater than us, right?
Right.
To remind us that we're all in this together, that somebody's watching. I thought that was so fascinating. So it could be, there's so much potential in that.
Sure. No, I agree. And those are the kind of things, rhetorically speaking, that you have to focus on, right? What kind of moments, what kinds of ideas or words or emotions can you draw upon to galvanize a certain kind of worldview, a certain kind of perspective that's infused with hope, but also action, though. So when we talk about this hope and you're thinking about it right now, mm-hmm. I don't want to have a false hope or an over-idealistic hope either, right? Like you were saying earlier, you know, changing the world takes work. It's a lot of effort. It's a lot of struggle. It's not all pleasant. I've sat in meetings for hours and hours, and they're miserable, right? That's kind of work you have to do in order to sustain your hope, right? So it's not a false hope. It's a hope, though, that you actually work for and you create as you do it. And I think that's important, right? It does take risk. It does take efforts.
Yeah, and I think that that's an awesome point. One of the things that I say, you know, I teach this class, like I was saying before, Activist Writing Media, and one of the things that we talk about in that one is another class called Rhetoric Democracy Advocacy, where we're talking about the real work of social movement building.
Right.
It's that stuff that it's, you know, frankly, it's not sexy. Right. And it is work. It's the kind of stuff that can be disenchanting. It's the kind of stuff that could, you know, we talk about burnout all the time in the movie.
Right. All
right?
the time.
Because you have people that step up and things like that, they get exhausted. And, you know, everything from writing those little memos, writing letters, to responding to people, to setting up meetings, all that kind of stuff is actually the real work of social movement building. And so we do, I think, need those things that are going to sustain us. They're going to remind us that it's this, the drudgery that we are going through throughout that process, just like everything else in life, right?
Right.
We do this for a reason that's beyond just those particular meetings. And I know I'm really hopeful. I see some hopeful signs coming out of some of the organizers that have organized around the Bernie Sanders campaign, who are really committed to the message, you know. And what's interesting, I'm forgetting where this was published. It was a piece. It was, I think, it might have been in Bloomberg News. Actually, there were some interviews done with some of the activists that had long-term activists from Occupy Wall Street. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they had said, this one woman in particular, I'm going to space her name, but she was saying, look, Bernie Sanders, like, we're not in this movement, right? Because Bernie Sanders suddenly appeared on the scene.
Right.
Bernie is one of us, right? And he is saying the message that we've been saying in Occupy Wall Street. And frankly, when Bernie's gone, we're still going to be here.
Right.
And I think that, you know, the fact that we've got seasoned activists coming out of Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter. And frankly, I'm a bit surprised that we haven't heard more about the feminist activists who have been on the front lines for the past 8 years. This is the thing that's baffled me about this whole campaign. This is kind of a separate aside, but it's baffled me about this whole campaign, about how the Republican war against women has not been front and center in a lot of these discussions. Not that it's absent completely,
sure.
But in my mind, that's the kind of, like, you know, the third, you know, the,
right, yeah.
the third leg of the stool on this movement. So there's a lot of hope moving forward. And I get concerned, and this is, you know, take it for what you will, that because there's been so much passion, that some of these new activists, especially, that have been energized by Bernie Sanders' campaign, are just going to kind of go away. Right. You know, what do you say to folks like that? What do you say to the people that feel like they've been burnt, they've been sold out, so therefore they're going to check out of the process? I'm not giving you softballs here today.
Well, activist burnout is something, it's very real. There's no doubt about that. And so I wouldn't want to dismiss someone for taking that route, but I would say you have to have a long-term perspective on social change, right? So the fanfare that surrounds Bernie Sanders, realize it's not about, it should not be about Bernie Sanders. It's not about one person being elected one time, right? But rather it's how do you create sustainable movements that are in for the long haul, right? And so it's not just about going to a rally or two and cheering for Bernie Sanders. It's about sitting down, organizing with your friends, your family members, and strangers, and literally thinking about this not just for the next 3, 4, 5, 6 months, but the next couple of decades, or perhaps the rest of your life, right? You know, the question Yep. becomes, what do you dedicate your life to? Is it to one election, or is it the next 30, 40, or 50 years of pushing for social change, right? And I think that becomes the question. And at the same time, though, having perspective and trying to avoid burnouts, right? Recognizing when you are feeling a little bit tired, a little bit stressed, stepping away for a while, and then coming back later on when you have more energy and more juice in your body. I think that's important. Also, it ties back to rhetoric. We tend to talk about rhetoric in terms of giving a grand speech, in front of thousands of people or using Twitter or writing an essay, but also how do we talk to each other during our meetings, mm-hmm. right? When we have differences of opinion, well, how can we be respectful of each other and work that out? Because I've been in meetings where they're exhausting because people are yelling at each other, right? Yep. So how do we use our rhetoric then, not just in terms of the grand spotlights? I think that's important as well.
Yeah, and also the role of, like, you know, watching, check on the shame stuff, right? The fact that when somebody is saying, look, I need a break, right? Sure. Then that's not seen as like a person that just doesn't have it, right? They're not committed enough. Right. I mean, that's one of those narratives that is all too prevalent in activist circles about, you know, your commitment to the cause, that if you can't, you know, stay up that extra hour in order to do this, then you know what, you know, you're not really in it. We've got to check that stuff too as well. And I understand where it comes from. I come out of punk rock traditions where you believe that, you know, you just freaking do it, man. Right. I don't see what your excuse is. You know? But, you know, as you start thinking about a movement and not just accomplishing this, the task that's right in front of you, it's something different. And, you know, when you use the word the long haul, and I think there's, you know, in some ways, no better model going back to the Highlander School, right? The Highlander School in Tennessee, and Miles Horton is like what they always, you know, this got born in the 1930s, right? That in Tennessee, right? Had, you know, cross-racial, cross-gender organizing, got their institute got burned to the ground twice, right? By the Klan and folks, yet they kept on doing it. And what came out of that? SNCC came out of that. Right. Like MLK got his training there. Rosa Parks got her training there. And they thought about themselves really much and everything that took place there as that long haul. Sure. You know, it's about building skills, building capacity, not just for the things at the tip of our nose, mm-hmm. But that's actually going to bring in a future of kind of justice for the long term.
Yes, 100%. And so rather than looking at all these things as separate moments, see them as a kaleidoscope of intersecting moments, right? Where each moment kind of bleeds into the next and helps advance that moment. I think it's too easy to say, well, Occupy was 5 years ago, or Bernie Sanders is today, or Black Lives Matter is a separate issue, or feminism is a separate issue. From my worldview, no, all these things intersect, right? And while we don't always agree with everything with each other, right, we're all kind of moving along a certain kind of similar path, all struggling for a better world and social justice. And if you have that kind of perspective, you can kind of see that what's happening right now is not just now. There's a long tradition with different iterations of that tradition.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. Well, listen, I want to go, before we kind of sign off for the day, I want to bring it back to almost a place where we started, you know? So, cause on the one hand, we've talked a lot about social movements and activism and so on. And I think about just your role. I mean, you're coming back to, you say you're involved in communications and communication studies, you know, you're an academic, right? You know, I don't know where the hell you get all the energy to write all the stuff that you do. I mean, this is only a start of it. I got, you know, on the shelf behind the big orange curtain over here, there's you know, we've got a couple more of your books out in a project that you've worked on. So, you know, I'm thinking about just that role of the kind of the intellectual, the scholar, the academic. And I'm curious about, you know, you told us where you started. I mean, you kind of look at yourself now and to position yourself now. I mean, how do you think about what is your role, right? As this academic, as a teacher, as a scholar, what is the place for people like us in this process? Sure.
My intellectual life is dedicated to social justice, right? Based on what I've experienced in life, based on my worldview, my politics. For me, if I'm going to be an intellectual, then I'm going to do it for the social good and for social justice. Now, obviously, not everyone has that worldview or has those values. But the way that I see it is that when you use your intellectual capacities, you're doing something in the world, right? Whether it's for good, for bad, positive, negative. But once you have that perspective, though, why wouldn't you use your intellectual abilities to make the world a better place? Right. And so for me, I could not live with myself if I wasn't working for social justice and social change. It's part of my DNA. It's part of my personal fabric. And that's who I am. And I wish more people, though, would do that. Now, having said that, it's not easy. Right. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say too much here, but in academia, it's not always supported. It's not always looked upon with positive eyes, things like that. So you put yourself out there. Like we were saying earlier, though, all social change comes with risk and effort. So if you're not willing to do that, then you have to find something else to do.
No, I think that's a great point. I always, you know, the message I always say is, look, you know, if you think about it, if you want to make a certain kind of claim, and this is always, I think, the challenge for those of us who are working with social justice, if you want to make certain claims about the way that the world should be, then we have to be able to prepare to kind of walk that road that we're talking about.
Right.
And it's different. It's not the same thing as the struggle you would have in the streets, but you have it inside the academy, and there's different things that happen there. But nonetheless, I mean, again, I think this is the rhetorical challenge, right? Is that as we shift spaces, we shift from, say, inside the university system to kind of out in the streets to whatever organizing moment we're talking about, the context is going to change and different, require different kinds of strategies and approaches. But the core of what we're working for has got to remain the same.
Yeah, and just one short point about that. Also, to be an academic, to be a scholar, to be a professor, an intellectual, there's a certain kind of privilege that comes with that.
That's right.
Right. So I get paid to read books, write books, talk, teach, etc. Right. And so if that's the case, though, why shouldn't I use my privilege to improve the living conditions of other human beings? Right. It doesn't make any sense. The fact that I can sit here on a Monday afternoon, have a conversation about these things is a privileged position where other people don't have that privilege, right? And so why not use that privilege for social justice?
Absolutely, 100%. Well, I'll tell you what, Jason, thank you so much for joining us on the sit down today.
I appreciate it. It's a good conversation.
Oh yeah, and I want to give people a little preview. So, you know, Jason and I were talking about this little kind of before the show and stuff. There's this little book here. I'm going to kind of introduce it here. This is Micah White's new book called The End of Protest, A New Playbook for Revolution. And I think we got some things to say about this book and some interesting kind of engagement. And so later on in the summer, we're going to have Jason back on to talk a little about this and maybe almost as either, let's say, a preview or kind of postmortem of what happens at the Democratic National Convention. As a way to frame maybe our discussion of Micah White. So you haven't heard the last of Jason Del Gondio here on the sit down, that's for sure. So once again, Jason, thank you so much.
Thanks again. I appreciate it. Have a good day.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, this is Kevin Mahoney. I'm the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press, and this has been the sit down. Today, we were talking with Jason Del Gondio. Now, remember, if you want to help this kind of media, if you want to help build progressive activist media, you can do it really easily, folks. You just go to ragingchickenpress.org, click on the support and membership tab, and say become a member. You can become a member for as little as $2 a month. Seriously, a cup of coffee, a beer, $2 a month. And that's a bad beer, by the way, $2 a month. Help build this movement, help support our work here. And don't forget, every Tuesday, we also will have Out to Coop. Sean Kitchen will be returning us, I believe, in our next episode of Out to Coop, which is pretty freaking cool. He's been out in Colorado. So tune in every Tuesday for another edition of Out to Coop. And of course, look forward to more of the sit down. This has been Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We're out of here. See ya.